the theme for the afternoon talk is the four most common views. With the talk this afternoon, I just like to speak with regard, refer to a general overview for a moment, and then in the very specifics of our Dharma practice, meditation and inquiry. We live in a culture and climate which provides us with immense opportunities for various kinds of dialogue and communication. We quite often, in the way that we have been conditioned since babyhood, childhood, and through, that the world would appear to be, shall we say, very dualistic. And there is tremendous effort from the powers to be, that is, people with great authority, who wish to impose the dualistic view upon us. And that may show itself in a variety of ways. A very common one, of course, is the us and them viewpoint. And this can show itself in the various views and standpoints of various groups, organizations, countries, regions, and so forth. And it's these viewpoints which arise also arise in our meditations as well. And we've come to look at life far too easily in a dualism as well of comparing oneself with others, in a dualism of competitiveness, which is strongly realized to the point that those who believe in competitiveness and advocate it strongly will make the outrageous claim that that is what it means to be living in the real world. We live in a climate and culture where the pressure on a person to have either a yes, which is one strong view, or a no, and that pressure to take one side or the other. And this view, consistently imposed, puts pressure on the individual. And that pressure limits our way of relating to life in the language of yes or no. Just think about some of your meditations for a moment. Think about some of the thoughts that you're having. Think about, shall I do this or shall I do that? Shall I say this or shall I say that? Shall I go to an interview with one of the teachers or shan't I go? Shall I get up early or shan't I get up early? Shall I do that wretched 45-minute standing meditation in the afternoon or not? So the dualism, shall I or shan't I, it haunts, understand the word haunts? It pervades, it corrupts human life, and we seem to end up living in a wretched state of either being for or against, or unable to make up our mind. It's no way to live. It's the propaganda machine. It's the pressure. It's all the deceptions that we are told about. We have to compete. Life is competitiveness. It's us or them, in all the ways that may show itself. In the tradition of the East, take the four common views, and I'll weave it, if I can, into the meditation, gives two other areas. So, to look at carefully, they are views which are common to the entire species without exception. Yes, no, both, neither. Yes, no, both, neither. And in our reflections, In our looking at the view which manifests out of the human being, all 7 billion of us, at any given time, it can in itself lean towards one of those four. There's no fifth in terms of the view with the opinions that go with it. And sometimes we are told to hold on to a view. We hear this regularly enough. Hold on to your view. In Dharma, holding on to a view is dangerous. Holding on to a view can be yes, no, both, or neither. And when a human being doesn't understand the clarity of the heart and the mind, the holding on to the view will generate in the relationship to the other a conflict. It has to. One cannot have holding in life without a conflict. Think about it. Think about anything in life you are holding on to. It could be the conflict and the fear of losing. It could be the conflict inside of oneself. Is this the right thing to hold on to? It could be the conflict with the other. She, he, they has a completely different view. And they are holding on to their view. Their yes, or their no, or their both, or their neither. Just as much as I am. How can human beings, in looking at the relationship to life, come to wisdom and clarity through holding? The holding is, Buddha's language for a moment, is the inflammation, that's the word that's used, to inflame. Do you understand to inflame? It's the inflammation of the self around the viewpoint. And in that holding, there will have to be a contraction. And the contraction will have to generate a resistance to the other view. And that is called war. War and conflict and arguing and putting the others down is the signal of the lack of imagination and intelligence. Every time. And we wonder, why is it? Because the I, the self, says, I am so right, whatever it might be about, and you, whoever you are so wrong. How is it, and think about this, how is it that I'm so absolutely certain of my rightness about my viewpoint that the other cannot hear it? Why is it that one is so absolutely certain and one has got every rational, reasonable argument towards the other, and she or he or they absolutely refuse to accept it? Why does every argument end in failure? Maybe it is the occasional one when somebody agrees because they're so tired of arguing. So does it mean we are afraid to live with a yes or a no or a both or a neither? Does it mean we have to become quiet, passive Buddhists, terrified of expressing an opinion? Because that's what goes on in some of these circles. Because it might upset somebody. It might disrupt their chain of thought. And can we as a human being, in our meditations and in our days here, have a relationship with the view, the four kinds I just told you, not just the two common ones in the West, but the four equally important. Can we have a relationship to the view, the yes, in which one can put hand on heart, one is staying true to that understanding, true to that principle, true to that ethic, but it's not going to be used to be in conflict with the other. It's not going to be used as a weapon against the other. One can stay true to one's religious origins, true to one's cultural upbringing, true to the appreciations of one's society. And in the depth of that being true to that, it doesn't mean to say a single thought, nor a single word, nor a single action has to come out in some way or other which inflicts a situation of conflict and violence, verbal argumentativeness, friction. This is an important area. Can I stay steady with the view? You know, Christopher has the views. As views, you know, are saying yes to friendship, yes to kindness, yes to respect for others in the diversity, saying no to war, no to violence, no to conflict. And those, so far, that might change tomorrow, but so far, these views have stood steady over the decades. They haven't changed. But it doesn't mean to say that therefore, through staying true to an ethic or a principle or a respectful relationship to people, animals and the environment, it then gets used to harass and put blame and attack the other, which has a different view. Because if I do, I reinforce their view. I have to. If I'm holding to a view, I'm giving support to the opposite view, which is far away from mine. And sometimes we've got to dig a little deeper. And it could be, in our meditations, in our days, with yes or no, and sometimes the reflection might be with both. And what I mean by this is, let me have a little bit of water here. The validity, when we look, you're sitting in your meditations, you're standing in your meditations, and I know it's happened for some of you because there have been conversations about it, and you've been having some thoughts about the other who is an important person in your life, the other who is a group or a society or your neighbours or whoever it might be. And you've noticed that yes, no, both, in this case the both here, that there is a conflict and attention and tension around her, him or them. It's coming up strongly in your meditation. You have a picture of the other there. There's a story going with the other. And in order for the conflict to keep going, it depends upon us maintaining the gap. I have to experience the gap. I am like this, she or he, they are like that. It might be true, I'm not saying that you're making it up. They might be like that. But in that gap between yourself and the other, there is no possibility of bridging the gap. And the self, who is the gap maker, that means the history, which means the memory, keeps the gap going. And if we're to use the language of both here, if I look and I see my thought, which is the measurement, keeps going over the gap between me and the other, between us and them, keeps going over the gap, then something has to change to reduce the gap. And the change is very simple. The change to reducing the gap is both. What do both have in common? like birth and death for a start. One of the Buddhist monks, in typical Buddhist monk style, said, why are there wars? Why do people go to war and kill other people? They're going to die anyway. So in the exploration of the gap there, both is to recognize and to be able to acknowledge what is in common. And we may resist touching upon what is in common, because if we do, it's going to change our whole view of existence. It's going to change our whole way of relating with the other, because we're seeing something in common. It will affect what we write, what we say, what we do, our way of living, because we recognize something deep is in common, and that depth is more important than this gap with the potential for the anger and the blame and the rage and the guilt. And therefore we're interested in the deep, what there is in common. And it's not to say, I don't also buy this spiritual baggage of, oh, we are all one. I don't know who the people are who dream up these nice, comforting views there. There are lovely experiences of oneness. And some of us, and perhaps plenty of us, have had them. I hope you all have had them. And if you haven't, what the hell are you doing with your life? So the experience of profound oneness is really a precious experience. But it's not going to resolve the question of yes, no, both or neither. It's not going to resolve all the issues. It can be a support. It can tell us another way of looking, another way of feeling there. And it could be that in the exploration of this, when one is really in an irritated state with the other, usually called our loved ones, which is slightly ironic, and when one is in an irritated state with the other, sometimes, you know, I love the Buddhist tradition, not all the time, but as much as I can. And sometimes we get the idea, when we're agitated or we're irritated or we're blaming, oh, we'll do a metta. Some of you may have even heard of this word, it's unfortunate. I'll do a metta meditation. So I'm really pissed off with somebody because what they did or they didn't do. And now I'll do some metta, that means loving kindness. Meditation and friendship meditation. And genuinely, I have to say this, you know, it's being politically correct here, but generally, there are lots of people here and elsewhere, they say, Christopher, I've got so much benefit from these loving kindness meditations. Why do you knock them? No, I appreciate the value of them. My concern, this is the point, in blame and anger, the purpose is not to go to love and friendship. It can be too much to ask a human being. Not even in the teaching. It's too much to ask that when there's some real agitation and conflict and confusion there, and then we impose upon ourselves this, oh, I should have more loving kindness. It's a horrible trip to lay on oneself. This is how I should be, and I'm not. And if I'm not, then I'm a bad person. Then one starts feeling really guilty because I'm not a Buddha, or even worse, I'm not a Buddhist, or whatever. So it's not to make a shift from the conflicts and the issues that go on into loving kindness. It is too big a shift for many people. But can I just see enough in common in the human field with the other, which then brings an end to the blame, the guilt, and the reactivity. That's all. No demand on oneself to be a nice, sweet, kind, loving person. It's romantic. And therefore, if kindness and friendship and love come, it's not because the self has put pressure on you. It's coming out of the being which is receptive. It's coming out of your understanding rather than feeling I should and I ought to. Sometimes people have been violated and abused and very badly treated at different points in their life. And then one says, oh, I should feel compassion towards this person. Why should you? Why put that kind of pressure on yourself? It's not always possible. But can we be clear and steady with these difficult past events? And there's just enough understanding to stop the blame. Maybe to take action, to do the steps which are necessary, to hold a person accountable. Yes, yes, yes. But with the blame, it means we are unhappy. We feel sad. We are burning up inside. And in a way, we're still giving the other authority over us. And it's a tremendous exploration in life to find a place of steadiness somewhere between the blame and trying to feel kind. Kindness is an emergence. It will come out of the non-blame of itself. It's a little similar in the meditations themselves. There's a lot of, emphasis on being here and now. There are certain books about it. I won't mention them. You might go out and buy one. And if you haven't already. And there's quite a lot which is, in terms of the bigger picture, small change, but quite a lot which can be useful about that there. But if it is exaggerated, that means being in the here and now, if it is exaggerated, the here and now is not liberating, it gets in the way. Don't be misled with these charismatic authority figures who tell you, oh, there's only the now. It's nonsense. Anybody would want to be stuck in the prison of the now all the time, well, good luck. The now is a tool. It's useful. It's beneficial. It helps and contributes to connections and much, much more. But very easily and understandably, through the repetition, be here and now, be in the moment, moment to moment, through the repetition of it, the mind remembers the repetition, and then the view comes out of the repetition. Oh, as people will say to me, oh, I realize Dharma or or the teachings, it's all about being in the moment, like hell it is. It's a resource. And it's not, the importance is not what the here and now is, right? In this moment, we are here in the hall, Christopher's doing his offering the afternoon teachings, you're very kindly listening, we can hear the fan. Lovely, pleasant afternoon. Maybe it may have stopped because of the talk, but, you know, optimism. And all of that is going on. It's the presentation. Understand? The here and now is a presentation. It's a presentation which is useful. It's a presentation which is not requiring a lot of memory. It is not requiring future planning and idea. But the teachings are not about living in the presentation. Not about that. The teachings are about realizing and seeing what has not been seen before. Understand the difference? One can be in the here and now, morning, noon, and night, God help you if you are, morning, noon, and night, and the ego comes in and thinks, oh, I've got it. I'm really in the now. I've missed the point. It's a presentation which is offering an opportunity for seeing and knowing that which has not been seen and known before, ever, in your life. And with that, it is also important to say that there is no singular. Anybody who says, and one hears it and reads it, and if you do, just start yawning, who says, I have got it. I am enlightened. I am liberated. I achieved the supreme. I know the true self. I have found God and all the other boring mantras there. It is already to set a restriction. Understand? Oh, I've had an experience, a profound experience. Now I am enlightened. I have had this extraordinary meeting with God. Now I have found God, or whatever. In these teachings, there is no, it's limitless. It is infinite discovery. It's not confined to one event. Because if it is, it's finite. And if it's finite, it's just another finite. Do you understand? No, had to go in the wrong direction. Yes, no, both on either. Sometimes we look, we search, it may occur, a really precious and important experience. There is a large range of them. I say it would be a pity to confine the infinite potential and the infinite ranges of experiences to one. Do you understand? I think, to me, it's restrictive. I don't want to live in a box. I don't want even to say, I got it. I don't want to limit the infinite to the finite. I refuse to live like that. And out of the experiences, the ordinary and the everyday experiences, even in the most ordinary experience, and people will say, oh, Christopher, I'm doing my meditation practice, I'm sitting and walking, I'm keeping to the timetable, and honestly, I'm not getting anywhere. Honestly, I'm not getting anything out of it. But the self always wants something, doesn't it? Even in meditation, I want to get something out of it. There's nothing to get out of it. It's a frustrating viewpoint. It's not about getting anything out. It's just in the moment when one says, oh, my practice doesn't seem to be leading anywhere. It feels like it's stuck. It was working for me, but now it isn't working for me. And all of that carries the yes and the no's, and yes, it is working, but really it's not working, or it might be working, or maybe it's none of all of that. So yes, no, both, neither, with the view of the meditation there. Rather than get lost in the viewpoints, yes, no, both, or neither, could it be we are a little bit blind to the extraordinary in the ordinary? It's not a matter of getting something out of it. Could it be that in the most small and ordinary ordinary, non-special event, you know, which is nothing to write home to mummy about? Could it be just in the most ordinary, the transcendent, that means that which is bigger than what's seen? The extraordinary can stand out. Even when washing the dishes, even when brushing the teeth, even when sitting on the meditation cushion. That sometimes in the ordinary, rather than the self saying, this is not good enough, I want something better, could it just require, not an effort, because that puts the pressure, just a little bit more curiosity, a little bit more interest in this extraordinary expression of life. And it's not that in that moment, through that little extra interest and curiosity, that something is going to burst out of it. But you are sowing the seeds for it. You're not content just to be in the here and now. You appreciate it. It's a presentation. And in that presentation, there is much to be realized and discovered. And there is no limit to that realization and to those discoveries. They are infinite in number. And there's something adventurous. And that's also not confined to being in the present. And what that means for us as well. We have as much opportunity for waking up and profound realizations and liberating insights by referring to the past. We are not confined to the here and now for profound realizations. That we can, to use the Buddha's words, squeeze the honey out of the past. And sometimes you will know, and I've heard your good voices, perhaps you've been on a retreat here at Eindhoven, or you've been somewhere else, retreats, yoga, practices, nature, whatever it might be. And you've noticed in the time here, as a small example, that your good interest is moving away from the present moment and appropriately going to the past. And you perhaps have said to yourself, gosh, I remember in this place and whatever place, this situation, whatever, really something really important touched me, happened, occurred to me. The self, that means the I and the my, so this was my experience, and when the experience is held onto, the indication is I go to the past and I want to repeat it. I want to have it again. And it's happened a few times over the years where a person on the retreat has had a real, on a past event, it could be a retreat, could be, as say, out in the nature. It could be having a beneficial hit of ayahuasca or whatever it might be. And says once, so gets grasps onto it and is trying to find it again in the retreat. The proof of the grasping is trying to repeat the history. That's what grasping is. Can we, rather than wanting to have that experience again, quietly turn the attention to that experience, not say, oh, I must let it go, I'm into letting go, drop it, etc. Something out of the experience keeps coming through. It's calling for your attention. It's kind of saying to you, you haven't squeezed the honey out. there's more insight in that experience than what you realized. You had some clarity from that, you had some insight, but it's coming back again and again. Whoa, let me forget the present moment. Let me go to that experience. What can I understand from that? The Buddha said to, for the first six, this is a slight sideways step here, for the first 6 years of his son Rahula's life, he was, the Buddha, when in his search, was a totally absent father. I had a totally absent father for the whole life, but he had a totally absent father for for 6 years. When the realization came, he went from being the absent father to a totally dedicated and committed father. He woke up to his care for his son, Rahula, and in one of the conversations with his son when he was older, he said to him, all those who have come to profound realizations about life have engaged in reflection with regard to the past. All. And it could be, therefore, to repeat a little bit, there may be important experiences in your life, and they, in this case, of course, I've got the spiritual ones in mind here, the great range of them. And if they keep repeating, a little encouragement to go to that, and with a quiet question, is there something more I need to see here? Is there something more I need to understand here? Is there another voice inside? And that may emerge. If you feel clear and confident and trusting in your steadiness, you can do it with any experience, including the really difficult ones. To go to the difficult ones without projecting a lot into it, it will require from us a certain steadiness to be able to look at the old without dragging all the old stories and pictures and images. So our steadiness in the present is the immense support to look at the past, squeeze the honey and the insights out of it. How am I doing for time? Because I'm just warming up here, but anyway, a few minutes. Water time. Nice. The same applies with the future. Teachings are not anti-future. but when we, pardon me, give some thought to the future, it is vital that the future, whatever way it is, you and I might be looking at it, has a very immediate and direct relationship to what is happening right now in our life. Because the future can be like a huge gap, and all our frustrations or feeling of unfulfillment or fanciful ideas, like the future is such a big space, meh, we can put everything into it. We can put in that huge space called the future all of our hopes, and if you have hopes, be ready for the disappointments, because hope is building up and disappointment is bringing down. Obama builds up hope and the fruit of it is Donald Trump. Hope goes up, crash comes down. It has to be. So in one's relationship and in of the Buddha's Dharma, one doesn't find the word hope in this kind of positive light. The language is I wish something will take place, but it may not. Very down to earth. There's a single word for this, which I can't remember. I wish something to take place, but it may not. And if it is related to our present living situation, then from the being there, we have some thought about the future, and out of the being can come an action in relationship to it. Understand? I've got to stay very close to the present, because if I move too far away from it, there is a danger of getting into lots of projections, either fearful or hopeful. So the present gives us a certain strength, for sure. And to really, mindfulness is to make valid use of the past, valid use of the present, valid use of the future, and you will know it is valid. So let's say with a thought, you are sitting in the retreat here, and there is some action which you know you would like to engage in. You know it is healthy, you know it is ethical, it is caring, and therefore there's something in accordance with the dignity of life. You look at it, that is there. The only way we can know the validity or the authenticity is if we do it. It's confirmation that it is an insight and understanding is through the action. So in other words, you may sit in the meditations here, you may be sitting over a meal and you have the most wonderful ideas of what you would like to do, and you think, yes, 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 and there's only two more days to go in this hell realm, yes, 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 etc. And it's not revealing any insight. It's just a fantasy. It's just a nice, impressionable idea. And we're not in the business of that. We're in the business of living with time, called past, present, and future. Recognizing and being respectful to the relationship of the present to the future there. And finding the skillful means to make a clear thought or an experience or an insight or a deep feeling actually be actualized, actually get expressed there. And some situations, actually at this time in this world that we are living in, we may engage in actions. I've got in mind the diminishing of resources and population issues and loss of the rainforests and elements and climate emergencies and so forth. Though there is the passing of the years, still as a human being, one engages, hopefully, in certain actions or expressions or communications on these important things, and one knows one will not know if it has served any benefit, because the end of one's life is fairly close. But just because it's close, that means close to the end, or we know our life is a short experience on this earth, there is still the validity of the human being reflecting, meditating, experiencing, feeling, sensing, intuiting, and engaging in the action, though one may never see any consequence or benefit. And sometimes in life we do it because it's authentic. We do it because it feels valid. We do it because we've looked at this yes, no, both, or neither. And to help liberate up, to free up something, even though there may not be any personally known consequences or benefits or fruits or whatever. But still we do it, because it's the liberation of the action, it's the liberation of the movement, which is precious and beautiful. Let's have a quiet minute, shall we? May all beings explore the three fields of time. May all beings squeeze the honey out of the field of experience. May all beings live with love and liberation.